Welcome to Face to Face. I'm Brian Becker, and I'll be the host of this week's episode. This week, we're joined by Ambassador Phil Wilcox, and we're going to have a discussion about U.S. foreign policy, particularly focused on the Middle East. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thanks, Brian, for inviting me.
You're with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We're a nonprofit group that is devoted to educating the American public about the realities of the Arab-Israeli conflict and to promote peace, especially between Israel and Palestine. And we do this through advocacy, education, publications. We take a particular interest in the problem of Israeli settlement in the occupied territories.
And you are the distributor or collaborator with Landrum Bowling of a new video. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
This video is it's a 20-minute DVD called New Hope for Peace, What America Must Do to Bring Peace to Israel and Palestine. This is a series of interviews with four famous Americans, Jimmy Carter, Jim Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, all of whom have deep, long experience in trying to make peace in the Middle East. And they spell out how this can be done and why it must be done to protect American interests and to protect the interests of our friends in the Middle East.
Right now, we have a new president in Washington, President Barack Obama. Obviously, he has a big focus of Middle East, as have all presidents for the past six decades, I would say. There's a new president, new leadership in Israel as well, Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu has been known as part of the far right of Israeli politics, refusing to recognize even the possibility of a two-state solution, in other words, no state at all for the Palestinians. In 2003, Benjamin Netanyahu said if 40% of the population in Israel was to be Arab, it would be a catastrophe. Israel would no longer be an exclusive Jewish state or a Jewish state. If there were 20% of the population were Arab, that would allow that too would be a problem and allow the Israeli government to carry out even extreme measures. So what's the possibility for the peace plan that you envision, which I assume is a two-state solution, given the fact that the new Israeli leadership seems to be, even though it's tipped its head a little bit with some language recently to a two-state solution, in terms of its long political trajectory against anything that resembles a two-state solution or Palestinian state whatsoever?
Brian, you're right. Netanyahu's opposition to stopping settlements and his grudging acceptance of two-state peace would we has imposed various conditions, of course. That makes the problem even harder, but it's not impossible, and it's unfortunate that so many people have given up hope that there can be peace. There is a way to make peace. If the United States wants to exercise real leadership in a way that we have not done so previously, I think we can help the Israelis and the Palestinians out of this mess and protect our own interests in the process. It's not impossible, and I am encouraged by the fact that public opinion polls show that the majority of the Palestinians and the majority of the Israelis want peace and would accept a two-state solution if they believed it could happen. And I think it's our role to restore hope to both communities and to mediate a peace that would protect both their interests, creating two states and two capitals in the holy city of Jerusalem.
Now, the Israelis unilaterally withdrew from Gaza a couple of years ago. And in some ways, that was a second state. It was the state controlled by the Palestinians in Gaza. But that state did not have control over its own borders, control over its own airspace, control over its own ability to import even necessary goods to sustain civilian life. And then the Palestinians had an election, which by all international standards seemed to be free and fair. And they elected a Hamas-led government. And the Israelis then, not under Netanyahu, but prior to Netanyahu, imposed a very airtight economic blockade, depriving the people of food and medicine and access to energy resources. And there were, according to the United Nations, or was a development of malnutrition, great human suffering. How is it possible, given the imbalance of power, for the second state, the Palestinian state, like the state that may have started to develop in Gaza, not to be something along the lines of what the Indians experienced in the United States? In other words, put on a reservation without any military prowess, without any independent way to live, and subject to the desire of the dominant nation. How does that happen?
Well, I think you've explained it very clearly. There cannot be a negotiated, consensual peace between these two parties if it's left up to them, because one party, Israel, is occupying the other. It's vastly more powerful. That is why the United States has to intervene as a mediator, an even-handed broker, to provide some balance. And I think that's the intention of President Obama and George Mitchell. Otherwise, this conflict will continue. Now, there is a second problem. That's the problem of Palestinian disunity between Hamas and Fatah. And that's part of the puzzle that the United States has to address. In part, we're responsible for that division because we refused to deal with Hamas after it won a plurality in the Palestinian parliamentary elections. And we have refused to regard Hamas as a party to the negotiations. So the Hamas-Fatah conflict has to be part of our agenda, as well as the larger Palestinian-Israeli negotiation.
As of right now, both the Obama administration and prior to this, the Bush administration, dealt with the Palestinian Authority. They dealt with Fatah, the Fatah leadership, called the Hamas organization a terrorist organization, and having done so, make it impossible for themselves to enter into any kind of negotiations or dialogue with Hamas. And even with the pronouncements by President Obama that there's a desire for change, a new start, he identified settlements and the expansion of settlements as a major problem. As of right now, the United States still identifies Hamas as a terrorist entity. And is there any sense on your part that within the U.S. Congress or within the White House, that terrorist label of Hamas, which makes negotiations impossible, is there any chance of that actually being lifted?
I think there is. You remember the long and difficult negotiations in Northern Ireland. There was a lot of terrorism in Northern Ireland on both sides, but the British government never used the word terrorism. And I think it's a mistake to focus on terrorism. Of course, Hamas has committed acts of terrorism in the past. In the early days of Israel's struggle against Great Britain, it also carried out acts of terrorism. The point is that Hamas is a major political element, and it has to be dealt with. It's not going to go away. It's also a varied organization with elements that are pragmatic and moderate and elements that are extreme. There will not be peace unless there is Palestinian unity, so it must be an objective of the U.S. to try to restore Palestinian unity and in some way reach out and communicate with Hamas, because they're part of the problem. They need to be part of the solution.
And do you think it's likely?
I don't know, but I think that if the president is serious, and I believe he is serious, and wants to do what no other American president has, he's going to have to find a way to deal with Hamas. That's what we did, you recall, back in the 1980s, when finally, after 20 years of avoiding any contacts with the PLO, through third parties, we engaged in a dialogue with the PLO, and ultimately there was an agreement, and we began to regard the PLO as a party to the process. I think we'll do the same thing with Hamas.
So, Ambassador Wilcox, we're talking about U.S. policy towards the Middle East, and in particular the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's the new movie New Hope for the Middle East Peace, which interviews Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his national security advisor, James Baker, who amongst his different positions was Secretary of State during the first Bush administration, and General Brent Scowcroft, who was the national security advisor under Bush. We want to go to a clip from this new movie, which outlines a contour for what these policymakers and perhaps yourself believe could be the foundation for a comprehensive peace settlement in the Middle East.
You know, by the end of the Clinton administration, the Taba Accords had set out basically the four major areas of contention. 67 borders, Jerusalem shared, no right of return, and a non-militarized Palestinian state.
I think there may have been a consensus among those four individuals that the Taba Accords, the 4 points outlined by General Scowcroft, were the foundation for a comprehensive peace settlement. Now, I wanted to ask you in particular about point number three, because that is the dividing line within the Palestinian community, point number three being no right of return for the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1948, during the formation of the State of Israel, in what the Palestinians call al-Nakba, the ethnic cleansing that took place, 750,000 Palestinians were driven or left their home because they were afraid. There were massacres like the massacre at Deir Yassin and others that are well documented. Since that time, those 750,000 people have many offspring, maybe totaling 6 million Palestinians around the world. People who, because of the war in 1948, have become stateless people, people without citizenship. And the recommendation by General Scowcroft and by the Baker-Hamilton report was no right of return. Now, the UN in Resolution 194 that was passed in 1948, a resolution that seems to be forgotten, says that it's the right of the Palestinians who were driven from their villages and homes to return to Palestine. That's a dividing line within the Palestinian community, too. Do you demand the right of return for the evicted people? How could there be really a comprehensive peace settlement without that issue being addressed in a way that speaks directly to the needs of the refugees, those who are still alive, and to their children and grandchildren who have claims to historic properties, family farms, family villages?
It has to be addressed, but there has to be compromise, major compromises on both sides. The Israelis are going to have to abandon this adventure in occupation and settlement of the West Bank and of East Jerusalem to share Jerusalem with the Palestinian state. And that will be a formidable challenge to Israel to make that compromise. The Palestinians are also going to have to compromise on the implementation of the right of return. They will not abandon the right of return. They will, and for good reason, cling to the principle that they were deprived of their land and their homes in 1948. But to demand the literal implementation of the right of return will prevent a division of the land into two states, because even the most dovish Israeli leadership would never accept that for fear that it would result in not one Palestinian state living next to Israel, but two Palestinian states, because of the demographics of a large influx of Palestinian refugees and their successors into the state of Israel. So the right of return will have to be satisfied symbolically and perhaps with a modest number of returnees in the form of family reunifications. I say symbolically. I think that the Israelis should consider acknowledging what happened in 1948 and their responsibility for the exodus, the forced exodus of some 800,000 Palestinians. But to expect an objective implementation of the right of return is to prevent peace and the creation of two states.
I think the right of return, myself, is the nub of the problem. And I don't think that there's sort of a symbolic way to overcome it. Perhaps there will be proposals, although I don't think any of them are being seriously entertained within the Israeli body politic. In fact, it seems that the Israeli body politic is shifting in a direction to the right and in a hardened sort of anti-Arab position. I think that the election of Netanyahu, the rise of Lieberman inside of Israel, which is by all definitions a racist program in the case of Lieberman, and I believe Netanyahu as well. What hope is there for the Palestinians that this fundamental issue can be addressed? Now the right of return was acknowledged by the UN in 1948. There are still many, many villages in Palestine that were evicted people that are still unoccupied. The exclusivism of the Jewish state seems to me to be the issue with the right of return. In other words, if the Israeli political leaders are insisting that there be a Jewish state, even though Muslims and Christians live in the borders of 1948 historic Palestine, what is now known as Israel, I don't see how that gets remedied. If the Israelis say to the Jewish people all over the world, you have a right to return. My wife, who's Jewish, and her children, my daughter, have a right to go to Palestine, to historic Palestine, even though they've never been. And yet the Palestinian people who were evicted from their villages don't have this right. And that seems to be a sacred clause within the Israeli body politic.
What you say is perfectly logical. But logic does not always dictate solutions. This is a conflict between two victims of history. The Palestinians, who lost their homeland to the arriving Zionists, and the Jews, who suffered a tragic history at the hands of Christian civilization in the West, culminating in the Holocaust. There is no just solution to the suffering of both the Palestinians and the Israelis. There just isn't. So we have to find a compromise if we want to rescue some degree of justice and peace. And if either side asserts maximal demands and is unwilling to compromise, both will continue to suffer. And I think there are public opinion polls that indicate that if the Palestinians were liberated in a genuine sovereign state of their own in the West Bank and Gaza, the capital in East Jerusalem, that they would be willing to compromise on all of the other issues, including the right of return. Because the Palestinians are a determined, resilient community, but they want a decent life for themselves and their children. And I think they don't want to continue this struggle in perpetuity.
The issue of the Palestinians returning to their home, is it possible that Muslims, Christians, and Jews could live peaceably in a non-theocratic state? In other words, yes, the Jewish people suffered one of the greatest crimes of human history, the Holocaust, and 6 million Jews were killed. But they were killed by Europeans. They were killed by a dominant, as you mentioned, Christian population, by Western capitalism. In other words, there was a social system, there was religious values. The Jewish people suffered so greatly. Prior to the Holocaust, I would say Zionism was probably a minority sentiment amongst European Jewry. And if asked, most of the victims of the Holocaust who were fleeing Europe, deciding that it was no longer hospitable enough to live, would have preferred to come here. But the United States did not have a hospitable attitude towards them, and instead, along with Zionist organizations and relief agencies and the British, funneled people into what is historic Palestine. And so the indigenous Arab people felt, I think, much the same way that the indigenous people in North America felt, that there was a funneling of colonial settlements into their homes. And rather than having the narrative being an endless enmity between two people locked in struggle, could we understand this as a colonial struggle or as an anti-colonial struggle? In which case, I could see a way to appeal to Jewish people, Muslims, Christians, all of those people in the world who, having gone through the experience of the anti-colonial period, the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, would recognize that there's justice in anti-colonialism and a way for people to actually live in peace in a non-exclusivist state. You think it's impossible?
Well, there's an old saying that the perfect is the enemy of the good. I would be delighted if Israeli Jews, Palestinian Arabs, Palestinian Christians could all live happily in a single democratic secular state. That's the ideal solution. But it's not going to happen, Brian. There is absolutely no evidence that those two societies would be willing to coexist peacefully as a single state. It would be a recipe for perpetual, continued ethnic conflict. Both of them are deeply committed to, in the Palestinian side, Palestinian nationalism, Palestinian state, and Zionism is Jewish nationalism. Who knows, if they were to divide the land and create two sovereign states, I think they would begin to cooperate in very constructive ways over time. And in 100 years, who knows what kind of entity
I want to make a prediction that in 100 years, there could be a democratic, secular,
it's quite possible.
A multiracial, multinational, multireligious state. Take the example of America. If people thought 200 years ago that black and white people would live as equals, as partners, with justice, it would seem impossible, especially given the fact that one people had been enslaved, the worst crime any people can endure at the hands of a larger, dominant racial society, racial majority. And yet, based on principles that are enunciated, articulated, not that racism has been overcome in America, but certainly major progress. But if you have the idea that America should be a white nation or a Christian nation, or any nation based on race, ethnicity, religion, it seems to me that that itself is the recipe for the endless conflict. In other words, the narrative is, and I think this is what happens with our current politics, is that people are told, let's be pragmatic, let's be realistic. The thing that should happen can never happen. And yet the thing that seems to be possible to happen, this two-state solution, is also not happening.
It is more likely to happen than to create one state in which the two communities live peacefully together. In fact, there's a de facto one state now. And it's a miserable situation in which is fraught with constant violence and hatred. To advocate a one-state solution is to advocate the end of the State of Israel and the end of Zionism. And there's too much history that led to the creation of Zionism and the creation of the Israelis to ignore. So as a practical matter, as hard as it is to divide the land and create two states, it's the only path to peace. And as you say, who knows what will happen in 100 years. I think if you separate those two people, they could coexist peacefully and constructively next to each other. But to try to leap over these two powerful nationalist movements and create a monolithic single democratic state, I think is impossible.
What about the Arabs living within the borders of Israel, who are second-class citizens,
yes,
based on the fact that we have an exclusivist state? I mean, must they leave in order for the peoples to get along? In other words, is there not some other remedy outside of the current framework that we can look at? Now, we have about a minute left,
sure.
So I'm going to ask you one quick question. Point number four in the Taba Accords that General Scowcroft mentioned was a demilitarized Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a highly militarized Israel and a demilitarized Palestine, how do the Palestinians see that there's a possibility of an equal relationship when there's been such a history of violence, especially from the state that is militarized.
Sure. I think you need security guarantees for both sides, and the international community is going to have to provide that so that the Palestinians can be genuinely safe and sovereign, and the Israelis can be as well. Many Palestinians accept the notion of a state that does not have high-speed fighter aircraft, tanks, armor, modern high-tech weapons, because what they want is the freedom to do business, to trade, to exist as normal people. They're very talented, industrious, and highly educated community. They are not a warrior people, and I think they would accept a state in which they had sufficient armed forces to maintain internal security, but which would not represent a threat to Israel or anyone else.
Well, the one issue I think with that, not, there may be more than one, but one would be control of borders. If the Israeli militarized state can shut off the borders as they have done with Gaza and deprive the people of food, medicine, and access to energy resources, how does the idea of a true sovereign state come into fruition?
It could not. A Palestinian state under those circumstances would not be free and sovereign, and there would have to be international guarantees to protect and maintain the sovereignty of a Palestinian state, as well as to protect the security of Israel. That's possible. And once these two people are divided, I think they would have a powerful incentive to cooperate with each other to provide for their mutual security. And the extremists, the fanatics on both sides would be marginalized.
Thank you very much. We're here on Face to Face. I'm Brian Becker, the host. We're discussing today the issue of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict with Ambassador Phil Wilcox, who's with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. They just released a new movie called New Hope for Middle East Peace. Thank you very much. We hope to see you next time.